Welcome. I'm Angie Cuero, and this is Your Call. 26.2 to Life is a remarkable documentary profiling men in San Quentin Prison sentenced to life. They are members of a running club preparing for a marathon. The battles they are in for are enormous. Perhaps the most intimidating is building and sustaining hope. The odds of any one of them running the Boston Marathon someday, or even the Beta Breakers, are worse than dismal. So let's put that in context. According to the Sentencing Project, 2 million people inhabit U.S. prisons and jails. That is a 500% increase over the last 40 years. And more than 200,000 of those incarcerated folks are serving life sentences, one of every seven in prison. Now, here in California, we have the second highest prison population, with over 100,000 incarcerated people. But it is possible for one to get out and fly up. One of my guests this hour did exactly that. He ran his first marathon under the eyes of a volunteer coaching team at the prison. But since then, he's run out in the larger world, including, yes, the Boston Marathon. 26.2 to Life premiered at Doc NYC. Since then, it has clocked multiple awards, including the San Francisco Documentary Festival's Audience Award and Santa Barbara International Film Festival's Audience Choice Award. Its virtual premiere is September 29th. More on that further into the show. Today on the Your Call, we are discussing the documentary, 26.2 to Life, in which we meet the 1,000-mile running club, the volunteer coaches training them, and the intimidating challenges both on and off the field. Let me bring on the director, Christine Yu. She's director, producer, writer, and a volunteer at San Quentin State Prison. Her earlier works are Wedding Palace and the short film Yellow Bell. Christine, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm really glad you're here. Frank Rona began coaching San Quentin's 1,000 Mile Club in 2005. He himself has been running all his life. And check me on this, Frank. I have that you've now chalked up 78 marathons and 38 ultra marathons. Have you added any events since then?
Actually, 39 ultra marathons. Uh-huh.
No one can keep you down. And we go to Markel Taylor. He's a marathon athlete, graduate of San Quentin's 1,000-mile club. He was released from prison in 2019, but not before qualifying behind bars for the Boston Marathon. He serves currently on the board of Marin County's Tamalpa Runners Club. Markel, welcome.
Thank you.
Christine, I have to pass on to you probably the highest compliment a documentarian can get. I watched this film with a member of my family, and the next day he said, "This film really made me rethink how I look at the prison system." And he used to think you did the crime, you do the time, period. And now he sees that the person who was convicted is not necessarily the same person that's in prison today. And that is the guts of the film, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that comment, because I went into this story with the fundamental question, can people change? You know, what does it actually really take? What drew these men to the starting line at San Quentin? Mm-hmm. And after, you know, several years now of observation, I walked away with a resounding yes, that people do and can change.
Tell me why you picked particularly the prison population to look for people who might be undergoing change.
Well, I became interested in prison issues because I had a friend who was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to 271 years in California State Prison. Yeah. And so that just really got me wondering and trying to visualize, how do people living life with a life sentence, I mean, what does that actually really look like? I mean, as you mentioned, the state of California has one of the, you know, largest prison populations in the United States. So a lot of people are suffering under these conditions.
Mm. What did you expect on your first day at the prison versus what actually happened?
My first day in the prison was actually to observe a half marathon event. When I first started my research process to what I thought was actually going to be a regular narrative motion picture. Mm. But that first visit really opened my eyes, even though I knew somebody who was in prison, my friend. I think because he was wrongfully convicted, I kind of disassociated himself, I think, with the rest of the population in that sense. Mm-hmm. And that first visit, it turned my, you know, eyes, I turned my perspective upside down And with that, I decided to that people really needed to see and hear the story of the Thousand Mile Club straight from the source. And so that's why I embarked on a documentary.
Well, one of the sources, obviously, is Frank Rona. Frank, you've been coaching at San Quentin for almost 20 years at this point in relative obscurity until now. But what did you make of someone who wanted to come in and make a film featuring your work?
Well, I had met Christine a couple of years earlier when she had read the article in GQ magazine about the club, and I was encouraged by what she planned to do, and I knew that she would do a good job. So I tried to work with her as best I could.
I'm going to ask you the same question I just asked Christine, and that is, when you decided to set this program up, or when you first stepped into the prison, San Quentin, what were your expectations of that first encounter, and what actually happened that may have contrasted with those ideas?
Well, I worked in for a construction company in San Rafael, and we did several projects at San Quentin Prison. So I had been in the prison quite a bit prior to getting involved with the Thousand Mile Club. So I was familiar with the prison, and I got a call from Laura Bowman, who was a teacher at San Quentin, and she had gotten a running club approved, and she was looking for a coach. So I decided I'd go in and coach.
Were you already in a position where you saw people in prison as human beings, no one to fear, you know, that there's no reason to be afraid going into a prison? Or did you have to find that out for yourself? Were you nervous on that first day?
Well, like I say, I'd been in there many times for projects that we were doing, and I met a lot of the inmates and talked to them before I got involved with the running club, and I felt comfortable with them.
Markel, I want to bring you on, and it's not just Christine's choice to focus on you in the film, but I'm sure that had to do with your face is arresting, your story is arresting, and your presence is superb on camera. Your presence is riveting, and since your release, the story has attracted a lot of attention. You were featured in 2 New York Times pieces and a lot more coverage. So what do you think draws people to you as key to the story?
Well, I have a very interesting background or backstory, as you will. So I think a lot of people can connect and relate to not only just running, but people are curious and interested in what goes on in prison. And then a lot of people want to understand why people commit violent crimes. And sometimes there's more than just the person's life crime. What happened before that is what people is interested in, and what people are doing once they have a second chance is what people are doing. So I look at all of those things, all those variables, and I say, hey, you know what? If I can share this and tell my story with the film as a platform, then I think I can do the job that's necessary to help people.
And that would include, of course, this is at your discretion every time the question comes up, but when people hear this person used to be in prison, I think it's intuitive for them to say, well, what for? Why were they in there? And your story is told. And I just wonder if people come up to you with that curiosity, and you've probably told that story, you know, I don't know, hundreds of times at this point. I wonder what that feels like for you to keep going back to that point in your life, which was the least pleasant, most hurtful, most terrible time in your life.
Yes, I wondered about that before, and I take the training in the prison through a lot of self-help and work that I've done on myself in these different variables, self-help and also in my spirituality, that I used to get frustrated and it used to bother me. But once I understood what was going on and how I know that today is more of a way to continue to grow and learn. And it's like every time you watch a movie that you're very interested in, that's a really good storybook, that you always find more and more out of it as you read it. And that's kind of what I do when I reinvent myself as I retell my story and reconnect to my past traumas.
I found myself wondering what it would be like to be the one person in the Boston Marathon that so many cameras are on. I see the pictures of you in the New York Times, and there you are in that screaming yellow shirt you have, or yellow-green shirt, glows in the dark. And I just, it's so different from your experience behind bars. I mean, to be celebrated, to be noticed, and to have your accomplishments out there in public, what does that feel like?
It's still surreal, just like how I felt in the film when I was in the coach's car looking around, just being amazed and appreciative and extremely grateful for being free. I feel like that today when I'm out there and I'm affecting people in a positive way, that's helping people to heal, to find themselves. I think that's my lifetime passion, to like help other people and help them to get what I got, to feel good about myself and to have 22 years sober. And, you know, just these things that are all powerful for one to build the self-esteem that's needed to be successful and happy in life.
Mm-hmm. Frank Rona, Coach Rona, one of the challenges I mentioned earlier in our show is the fact that people are going around and around and around the same track. And it's when you think about the Boston Marathon or you think of the San Francisco Beta Breakers, you have all these different visuals to break things up. You have hills to break things up. You know, when you look around, it's not the same thing you saw 5 minutes ago. And I think that psychologically, that has a lot to do with a good run. So how do you instruct the people you're working with to get around a boring track again and again? What do they need from you to focus properly?
Well, they don't have many alternatives. So, what I try to tell them is, you know, once they are able to get out of San Quentin, that they will have opportunities to, you know, to run in places that are more attractive and more enjoyable. But while they're at San Quentin, they just have to do the best they can with the quarter-mile track we have there.
And that's a matter of something that I think every person in prison has had to confront, and that is acceptance. You've got what you got, and that's what you got. And it sounds as though this is just another layer of that, of accepting what life in a prison is like.
They don't have much choice. That's right.
Yeah. Let's talk about the actual running of the marathon. And Christine, this is how you structured the film. You introduce us to the various runners. We meet them and we talk about how the marathon is to be run. But the most of the action involves the marathon itself. And you intersperse that with interviews with the people that over the film we come to meet, the people who've been serving in prison, the people who may never get out. And then you go back to that marathon again. It's a wonderful structure for the film. And was that intuitive or was that something you came to arrive at?
Well, I think when I decided to do it as a documentary, it was just something that popped into my head, you know, that narrative structure. So yes, it was just something that happened. I mean, life is a marathon. You know, certainly the prison sentence is a metaphor, you know, for a marathon, or a marathon is a metaphor for that. Mm-hmm. So I felt like it went hand in hand. And, you know, to add to Frank's comments, you know, well, a lot of these guys, when they're running that track, I've been told they visualize themselves being outside, running with their family, running with their friends, seeing them and having that visual image in their mind while they were doing it made it very tangible for them. And then that visualization actually helped them to get out of prison, both metaphorically and mentally. but also in reality as well. And that is what was so powerful about being able to uncover this.
In terms of photographing a marathon, you have an obligation as a director, and then you have an obligation as just a human being. As a director, you want to get great shots. You want to get great sound, great light. And as a human being, you know it's not your place to get in these guys' way. There are no retakes. They're running a marathon. They can't be worrying about having a camera in their face. So how do you deal with that as a director?
Well, the San Quentin Marathon is a true athletic event, and I wanted to make sure that it was captured as the great event that it is. And so we did have multi-cameras. I think that, you know, we worked with a tight crew, and we went into, myself and my AP, Zahava Hirsch, we went into the prison as often as we could when cameras weren't rolling. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very important for us to have people be familiar and comfortable with us, have them realize that, you know, when a lot of people go into the prison with cameras, it's for a news story that maybe they're just there for an hour to get sound bites. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was important for me for people to know that we really wanted to get their entire story. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a bit of, you know, building trust and having them be comfortable with, you know, what we were really doing, and engaging them about having them understand what the process was.
Mm-hmm. Markel, with that first marathon that you ran behind bars, you're waiting to hear the starting signal. You know it's time to run. What's going through your mind?
Well, I always go into a race with a purpose. And my purpose is, for that day, is whoever I dedicated that run for. Mm. It could be for my victims, people who I've victimized in my lifetime, or my current victims. It can be people who are struggling for cancer or diabetes or heart attacks or cancer. So whatever it is, that's what I was dedicating that race for, in honor of and different people and different struggles. So that was my thing going in. And then after that was, okay, it's for them, but then also I'm worrying about who might be on my heels and who's going to be chasing me. So, but it takes the nervousness off when I do it for that cause.
Mm-hmm. You were actually an athlete earlier in your life, and it was an opportunity that kind of went away for you.
Yes. It's funny how things reinvent itself, and it seemed like it just came back to me to run again. Yeah, I had my junior year ran high school track, and then my senior year I ran cross country and track. So with that, I had that little bit of experience that allowed me to be able to further my education or my running career. Mm. But like I said before, the things I was going through in my lifetime, I didn't feel like I was worthy enough to even carry that through. So I, you know, one thing led to another, and I ended up in prison.
Mm-hmm.
However, that allowed me to reinvent myself once the suicide of my friend, after trying to go to the Board of Prison Hearings to petition for his release, he got denied and committed suicide. That's what allowed me to start running again, because it was now my turn to go up for board for parole or prison hearings for release the following year. And I didn't want to have to feel or go through the same thing he was going through. So I started running. And along with that, a friend of mine who was already a part of the running club asked me to join. And he said, if you join, you'll get a free hat and tennis shoes. And and it was something that I like gear. I like, you know, hats and shoes. And especially the stuff that I was given in prison is like, I hate to say it, trash compared to like stuff that these coaches were bringing in from the outside, from real stores and nice tennis shoes and, you know, stuff that you can really run in and feel good about yourself in, and, you know, and just better for your feet and your health. So that's what I did.
I'll stay with you for one more question, and that does have to do with the shoes. I mean, you can see as they're being checked out to you for each game, those are nice shoes. That's pretty clear they're nice shoes. But at the end of the day's session, you have to check them back in. They're not yours. You don't have the chance to, you know, partner with your shoes. You don't have the chance to break them in and just know that they're yours. And the great athletes have that, amongst other things. They've broken their shoes in. They're part of a partnership. And I wonder how different it is for you now. You're choosing your own shoes as opposed to these shoes belong to the state. I got to give them back.
It's interesting that you say that. Before, they didn't do that to the guys. They allowed the guys to take their shoes to their cell, and they actually own the shoes. But it's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes of people that get these shoes and don't appreciate them in a way that they can. They'll either take those shoes and sell them, because, you know, it is a prison, or they'll, you know, they probably won't be running as much. Mm-hmm. Whatever the situation is with that is, unfortunately, the administration in the prison took control of the shoes and started to make us lock them up on a yard, and so we couldn't bring them back to ourselves. And so with that, like, just the ability to go out and get your own shoes and run in different shoes, it makes for a better training process. And you can improve on your running. Shoes are very important. So I think that's what's good about being on the outside compared to the inside, where you don't have to have anyone controlling what you have and when you can use them and this and that. Mm-hmm. You can actually have freedom to switch shoes, change shoes, a training shoe to a race shoe, and vice versa.
But it stands for so much else, too. Markel Taylor is a marathon athlete. He's a graduate of San Quentin's 1,000-mile running club, and he's one of the focuses in Christine Yu's show, her movie, 26.2 to Life. She's with us, too, director, producer, and writer. Frank Rona is here, and he's been coaching San Quentin's 1,000-mile club for many years, and he's also a runner himself. We're going to take a little bit of a break here, and I want to let you know that you are welcome on the phone lines. We'd like to hear from you with any of your questions and comments at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Have you been impacted by the prison system? Have you been incarcerated yourself? Do you have a loved one there? Do you have a connection to San Quentin in particular? And what would you like to hear from our guests about the San Quentin Marathon? Again, the number is 866-798-8255. And we are a podcast as well as a radio show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there as well. I'm Angie Carter, and for Rose Aguilar, and we will be right back. And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Angie Carter. Frank Rona, coach who's profiled in the film 26.2 to Life. I want to ask you about the special challenges of coaching inside a prison. For example, there are lockdowns. We see one instance where the run is going, the race is on, and then the signal sounds and everyone has to crouch down, sit on the ground, and wait it out. And it can be anything from 30 seconds to half an hour. So how do you deal with that as a coach?
It's difficult. Over the years, we've had lockdowns where it went up to like 2 hours. And you just, you know, during the time that you have the lockdown, you know, all of the inmates have to get sit down or get on the ground. The volunteers can continue standing, but it's definitely a difficult situation.
Does your role at that point turn into that of maybe a cheerleader, letting them know, hey, this will be over soon, keep your mind? What did you tell them to keep their mind on so they can get back up and run with the most efficiency?
Well, depending on how long it, you know, the lockdown lasted, I mean, I would typically walk around and talk to the inmates and, you know, commiserate with them the length of the lockdown or whatever, but there wasn't really a heck of a lot we could do about it.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, there's kind of a theme in your answers. You just have to deal with what you have to deal with. There's not a lot you can do. Let's go to the phones. Brad in San Francisco has a question for us. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Thank you for letting me speak. Mm-hmm. My question is how would one go about introducing pickleball into the prisons? And yes, I'm an avid pickleballer, but one of the unusual things about this sport is not only is it healthy, exercise, all the things you would imagine, but it helps to really build communities, and it's fostered on people of all ages, all types, all ethnicities, all cultures interact together. So, and they welcome that. So I would like to get some input on how to do that.
That's a great question. Frank Rona, tell us how you got the program going at San Quentin. How much of that is transferable to getting another program in?
Well, all of the preparatory work was done by Laura Bowman getting it approved, and then she brought me in to coach the club. There are a lot of volunteer programs at San Quentin, and I'm sure that if you're really interested, you can contact San Quentin and get information as to how you could start a pickleball program there.
All right.
There was a pickleball day not too long ago. I think about a month ago, a coach had brought some nets in and some rackets in, and they did have something there. So, yeah, as Frank says, I'm sure you can contact that Office of Community Engagement and see what they have to say.
I have to ask you, Frank, was it easier for you to start the new running program at Washington Correction Center? You know, that road had already been trod. You knew more about how to get it going?
Well, actually, it took several years for them to get the one at the Washington program approved. I met with a gal probably 4 or 5 years before she actually got the program approved, because my son lives up in the Seattle area, and they did get it approved, but then during the COVID pandemic, everything shut down again, and my latest communication with the woman who was in charge of the program up there is that they're in the process of trying to get it going again, but they have not started it up yet.
Markel, something about thank you, Brad, for the question, and we'll take more of your questions on the line in just a moment. Markel, I want to ask you, though, one of the things that we see in the movie 26.2 to Life is that the area where people recreate is very segregated. It's even explained in the film. This is where the white people are. This is where the Hispanic people are. And there's the air of hostility between them. Tell me how that played out in getting the running team together, because you have to overcome some real intense feelings there to all work together. And the group is, the Runners Club is completely integrated.
Yes. That's one thing that's nice about San Quentin, mm-hmm. which is not like any other institution out there in California, that if you're in a program, that's the only time that you actually truly have a neutral ground where every race can congregate together peacefully without those repercussions.
So for the actual team to be integrated then was just an echo of what was already happening around the field.
Yes. If I'm understanding your question correctly, programs are the only way that people can congregate together without having setbacks or repercussions from their necessary race. Mm-hmm. Other than that, the yard is segregated. They have different areas where the different races hang out and work out. And yeah, that's how it is in prison.
Christine, I want to ask you about depicting that. There was one person you interviewed, and forgive me, I don't have his name. He was talking about the unanimity you have to have in prison. You had better be behind your fellow prisoners. You had better be, you know, ready to back them up should they want to riot or should they want to have any kind of uprising. And the way he put it was that if you don't get behind that riot, your peers will see that you are taken off the field. That's pretty intimidating. And I wonder why that, you know, you must be with us, you must behave the way you behave in prison, didn't translate over to the running club where people who were integrating seem to have a complete acceptance in the prison.
Yeah, again, a lot of those stories also, you know, San Quentin definitely is a different type of prison than any other prison in the state of California. Most people, by the time that they get there, have been through maximum, you know, hard time prisons, level four prisons. So, you know, those instances, especially with riots and other group violent group happenings like that, a lot of the guys have experienced those in these level four prisons. You know, over time, incarcerated people, there's a point system. Their point systems, you know, they're decreased. So they can go to a level two prison. And what a lot of people don't know about San Quentin now is, of course, we know San Quentin to be the notorious place of violence, you know, has storied in that way. But over time, it has evolved into probably the most progressive prison in the country. Mm. And that has to do with the location in the Bay Area. You know, Bay Area, of course, is a wealthy area, a lot of resources, a liberal community. So there are something like several thousand volunteers that pass in and out of those gates on an annual basis. And most prisons are typically in very isolated areas. So they don't have the benefit of community engagement. So our goal with this movie really is to, you know, one of our social impact goals is to get the film seen in other prisons across America to help make prisons more porous and, you know, encourage administrations to engage in volunteer and rehabilitation programs because it's, you know, proven that if people have access to programs, recidivism rates will go down, as is the case with the Thousand Mile Club.
Now, the sound that you're hearing in the background is a fire alarm going off, and I will I'll keep the show going until I'm told to get out of the building.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's part of the fun of live radio, I do have to say. We are going to go to a phone call after this alarm stops. So, Jeannie Marin, hang on to the phone line. We'll get to you afterward. And we'll just...
Now you kind of know what an alarm is like in prison.
Although we don't have to stop here. We just have to live with it. I want to ask you about language, because it's very important not to reduce someone to their prison sentence. You know, he is a prisoner or she is an ex-con. And that's something that's evolving, where we're learning to talk about the person instead of their personal situation. Markel, tell me what your thoughts are on that.
Oh, wow. That was so distracting. I couldn't even, I don't know where that came from. Can you repeat that question one more time?
Yes, and I do apologize. It's going to be hard. I was wondering how you feel about talking about people as not prisoners, not inmates, but people who are in prison or an incarcerated person, putting the person first as opposed to the description.
Yes, that's where we change our name to, or we would like to be called, incarcerated residents. Or they might have even changed it again since then when I was in there. But we are residents. It just makes it a new face. It's not just a thingifying or calling person something that's degrading and dehumanizing, but treating them as such as a human being. Because if a person feel like they're treated as a human being, they build that self-esteem and courage and confidence up. and they can be that human being when they get out on the outside. But if you keep dehumanizing the person and making them feel like they're nothing and ain't worth nothing, then they're going to act like such and be violent.
Christine, let me get your thoughts on that.
Yes, that was something that I learned while I have spent my time in San Quentin as well. Of course, many people still say incarcerated people are inmates, and that's sort of a popular term. But there is a movement to, you know, evolve that term now to incarcerated person or incarcerated resident.
It's one of those things you have to get used to. Frank, Rona, any thoughts on that?
No, not really.
Okay, not a problem. I do want to go to one of the very powerful points in the film, Markel, and that is when we see you on the track in the latter part of the scenes of the marathon itself. You were coming into where you were going to perhaps win, perhaps come in number one, perhaps best your time. Tell me what you were thinking at the end of the marathon.
I was so exhausted, and that was probably the slowest marathon I ever done, because the first one was my second fastest. The last one was my fastest to qualify me to Boston. So I think that one, because I only ran four, so I think that one was my slowest marathon at that time, and I was just exhausted, and I was just glad to get it over with.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know what we're going to do? We're going to take a little break here and go to some music while we figure out what to do about the fire alarm. It's the joys of live radio. Jeannie Marin, you hang on to that phone line, and we'll get to you next. As soon as we can get this noise turned off here on KALW, it's your call.